Hi everyone, welcome back to Less Panic, More Peace. We're back after a short hiatus of being busy with college applications and could not wait to get back on the podcast and introduce you to many more professional and intelligent guests. Today, you are in for a treat. We have a Cornell-trained otolaryngologist, entrepreneur, allergy expert, company co-founder, researcher, innovator, and stand-up comedian on the side. Introducing Dr. William Ryder.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, but I'm listening to that introduction of myself. I'm exhausted.
I can't believe too.
I've done all that stuff.
I think the first tip is to give us a little advice on how you fit all of that on your resume or even like your LinkedIn profile. Like, isn't there some sort of word limit or something?
Yeah, well, I think I exceeded that a long time ago. Yeah, I look at my own CV and I look at all the things I've done and I say, you know, wow, did I really do that? How did I fit that stuff in? And, you know, it doesn't seem like you're that busy when you're going through it, you know, particularly when you're excited about doing lots of things and very energized and passionate about a lot of things. It's easy to do that. But, you know, one thing I've learned, one of the big lessons is you've got to take time and slow down sometimes. You know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So can you just begin with kind of telling the audience a little bit about who you are and what you do?
So I am. I'm a doctor is one of the main things that I am. You know, that is my profession. I'm an ear, nose and throat doctor. And they decided to give it a really complicated name, otolaryngologist, just to confuse people. But I treat conditions of the ear, nose, and throat, and we do surgery involved in that area as well. And allergies is a huge part of my practice in ear, nose, and throat. So that's been a big guiding force in my career as well. I've been an otolaryngologist now for 25 years. And I can't believe it when I say that as well. I can't imagine that. It seemed like yesterday that I just graduated from medical school.
Yeah. So how did that all start? What was your motivation on being on? How do you? It's so hard to pronounce. I always
just say ENT. Just say ENT. That's
E-N-T. Ear, nose, and throat. Yeah. I think I said head and neck surgeon beforehand, but
neck surgery is part of our field. So it's otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, but let's just call it ear, nose, and throat. And and we'll just leave it at that.
Ear, nose, and throat. So how did you begin with that? What was the motivation for that?
Yeah, I was always confused. In medical school, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. You know, I had so many interests and it's really hard sometimes to make a decision. What really guided me towards this field was a mentor that I worked with who really helped me see the specialty for what it is and showed me the breadth of the specialty. And I saw how much it impacted people's quality of life. You know, my area is involved with hearing, smell, speech, so many of the things that go into us being humans, you know, and us being the people that we are. That really drew me to it. Also the variety, as you might be able to tell, I'm a person who likes lots of variety. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I saw that the patients I would be seeing, men, women, children, adults, everybody of every lifestyle, walk of life, and, you know, would have some reason to come to an ear, nose, and throat doctor at some point in their life. And that really drew me as well to this specialty.
That's great. So, as you know, this is an allergy podcast. So yes. Do you have allergies yourself? I know we spoke earlier, but if you can tell the audience a little bit about, you know, your allergies and anything about that regarding
that.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact, I do have allergies. I have some airborne allergies, and people always ask me, you know, is that why I went into, you know, this field and I'm doing allergies in my clinical practice? I think to some extent, doctors are always trying to fix themselves. So there's probably a bit of truth to that, but I've also grown up with a severe peanut allergy, which has had a pretty big impact in my life. You know, I grew up with peanut allergies at a time when food allergy wasn't really something that people knew a lot about. In fact, I thought I was the only person with this condition for, you know, maybe the first decade that I had it. I didn't realize that anybody else had it. So that definitely can impact the way you're growing up and the way you're interacting with your friends and everything.
Yes, I completely agree. I think when at a young age, during your childhood is the key moment where you start realizing your kind of your surroundings about, oh, okay, so this person doesn't have allergies. I'm the only one. I feel like an outsider. So I think back then, more than ever, it was way worse to deal with because no one really knew anything about it. Now it's the technology and the advocacy and the community is there. You know, we have that with us at all times, which is so amazing. But back then we didn't have any of that. And there wasn't an EpiPen, right?
No, there was no EpiPens.
There
This
was
was
no EpiPen.
the wild west of food allergy. I mean, if somebody went on and broadcast like you're doing about food allergy, I mean, people would have said, what is this person talking about? I mean, you are a testament to the fact that we have advanced so far in terms of food allergy that you're actually doing this podcast. But it was the wild west. I mean, it took a while even for my parents to bring me to the doctor to figure out why I was getting sick every time I went to a restaurant. And once the diagnosis was made just by pretty much guesswork on the part of my pediatrician, it was the advice was, well, don't eat any peanuts and best of luck. And that was it.
Yeah, the mantra was basically prevention, 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 and nothing about a solution or anything. It's kind of wild to me to think that there was no EpiPen at all. So what would you do? So God forbid you had an allergic reaction. What would you have done?
So what I did do, when I actually did have a severe reaction, they told me, of course, not to, when I went to birthday parties, not to eat any cake, not to eat any cookies. And I think my mother, even when I was an adult, panicked every time I went to a birthday party. So I would go there, and of course I would eat the cake, I would eat the cookies. So I did have a cookie once that had some peanut in it, and yeah, my throat pretty much closed up. I couldn't breathe. And my father rushed me to the hospital. He threw me in the back of his car, and we rushed to the hospital, and I got my epinephrine there. Thankfully, hospitals had epinephrine,
Okay.
but there wasn't any auto injectable epinephrine, so I just had to get there in time. I made it just in the nick of time to get a couple of injections of epinephrine, and it brought me back to this world pretty much. I
Yeah,
almost checked out a couple of times.
that's so scary. I actually have a friend who passed out from an allergic reaction and he kept having the EpiPen multiple times. He was on an island, he's allergic to dairy, nuts, everything. And he passed out completely and had to have multiple EpiPens in order for him to kind of, in a way, come back to life in a sense. And it's a really scary experience, even like watching somebody go through that or even hearing about it. It really resonates with me because it can really happen to anyone if you don't have the resources for this, this
It's a
allergy.
very scary thing. I can still, in my mind, I can think back and I can still remember how that felt, to have your throat closing up. And it is something that never ever leaves your consciousness.
Yeah.
You're always able to remember that to some extent.
Yeah, of course. And even going back to the name of this podcast, panic, the word panic and the feeling of uncertainty. And I remember every single time I would have an allergic reaction, I felt the initial thing was throat closing up, and then it would be, needles, feeling of needles in my stomach. And it was just those two indicators that, make you so fearful of eating those foods. Do you think that there's some sort of mental health perspective on it? I know there is, but there what is your take on the mental health side of allergies? I know we speak so much about the physical health, but yeah, what is your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, no doubt it affects the way a person thinks about themselves, the way they interact in the world. We were talking a little bit about growing up with food allergy, and as it is when you're growing up, usually even if you're very well adjusted and fit in with everybody, you still feel like you don't fit in. We all feel like that. But when you have something that's different and you feel almost defective in a way that you have a condition like that, it affects the way you interact. You try to hide things from people,
Yes.
and that's a tough way to grow up. And of course, there is that fear of having a reaction. You can have a potentially severe reaction, and that's a cautionary tale to really to educate yourself if you have food allergies or somebody that you love has food allergies or care for. educate yourself and empower yourself. You know, learn about EpiPens and how to use them and then carry them. I knew a boy who had, you know, bad nut allergies. I saw him in the office and he was a really, really sweet kid. And, you know, in the city here, we have these carts, like Nuts for Nuts. You know, they have these street vendors that have the roasted nuts, and it smells really great if you're a fan of nuts. But if you're allergic, it's not so great. And they're on almost every street corner. So this young boy had to take a very circuitous pathway to school just so he could avoid any street that had these Nuts for Nuts carts, because every time he saw one, he got like a panic reaction.
Yes. And even the smell, I is there some sort of, there's some sort of smell whenever I smell peanut or like butter, peanut butter or anything, I have this, it's like an automatic trigger. Like, okay, I'm not going to go near that. It's my sign of exiting that door and leaving. Is there some sort of relation to, you know, the smell and the taste? And even though I have not even tasted peanut butter ever. Uh-huh. I haven't. I've only had, you know, maybe nuts inside of a thing. So I haven't even tasted it before. So why is that smell so triggering to me?
The sense of smell is an amazing sense. And again, this is one of the reasons I love ear, nose, and throat, because it's so fascinating. You know, you can remember a smell or smell something that you've smelled 20 years ago, and it literally brings you right back to that point. It's like a super highway direct to your brain, you know? And so the sense of smell, it can really be a powerful force. And when you've had some sort of a reaction to something, or even a family member who's had a reaction to peanuts, that gets ingrained in you. And if you smell that again, it sends a very, very clear signal to your brain. That's very powerful. And that's how we survived as human beings, by knowing that things were dangerous, and also remembering smells that were pleasant as well, right? If we kind of smell somebody who we've loved from the past, you know, it brings back all these emotions. So it's good, and it's also protective for us. So yeah, if I can smell, if anybody in my office here, if they open up a bag of peanuts way at the other end of the office, I'll suddenly, you know, perk my head up, and I will find that. I can find them. I will hunt them down.
No,
and I know exactly that peanuts have been opened in their present. Very sensitive sense of smell with that.
And yeah, I can't even imagine dogs having a stronger sense of smell than humans do. I cannot even imagine having that. Well,
yeah, and dogs, it's for almost everything. They have an extremely great
smell.
They can recognize like one single dog. They know exactly where to find them.
I know. So can you tell us, I think what the audience really loves to hear, and I love doing these podcasts because each person has a story of their own and advice and tips that they share that, you know, touch the heart to many people who are listening. And I love watching a lot of videos of food allergies and everything and hearing all these stories. So what is a story that you can share maybe that can provide a little bit less panic and more peace, more certainty, more clarity, a feeling of hope maybe in our food allergy community, maybe any new technology, you know, tech advancements that you may have come across recently? Anything you would like to share?
Yeah, I mean, my journey through the allergy world, you know, really came about because I was trying to help my ear, nose, and throat patients who were suffering with pollen and cat allergies. And along that way, you know, what I saw, there's different ways of doing allergy desensitization, you know, for airborne allergies. A lot of people are aware of allergy shots, which are fantastic. They really work well. They've been around for almost 100 years. But you know what? People just don't really like getting shots. It's a tough thing to come into the office. So that really, you know, affected me a lot when I started my practice, and I was giving shots and then I was doing sublingual drops under the tongue, which was better too. But one thing that really bothered me was that young kids had a hard time doing that, you know, putting drops under the tongue and holding them for a couple of minutes, and they didn't want to come in and get shots for obvious reasons. So, you know, I saw that problem and I thought about it for a long time. And then I kind of worked out a bit of a solution for it. I figured out a way that you can actually deliver that same treatment by just brushing your teeth. So that was that started a very interesting story in my life, where, you know, to start from an idea that you have in your, you know, in your office, your clinical practice, or even at home. Actually, I had the idea when I was at home on one Saturday morning when I was just brushing my teeth. I kind of looked inside my mouth and I had this sort of idea that maybe we could deliver immunotherapy that way. Mm-hmm. You know, then getting it actually developed into the hands of people, it's a real journey. You know, I do research at my institution, so I did that. And then, you know, we started, you know, I formed a company to help develop that and help bring that to market for airborne allergies. And then we realized how good that could be for food allergies as well. So that was a whole story that's taken me a decade, you know, and now to the point where I'm working with a company that's in clinical trials, looking at a peanut toothpaste to desensitize people who are allergic to peanuts. And that has been just a fantastic journey, learning about the world of entrepreneurship and companies and how to take products from the idea stage all the way to, you know, practice and on the market. So yeah. It's available for people. So that's an amazing story.
Yeah, that is amazing. So can you please tell us a little bit about how, like the hardest part of that whole procedure of, you know, from the idea to now making the toothpaste, what was that difficult? What was the challenge amongst all of that?
Well, one of the biggest challenges, you know, once you have the idea is saying, well, can this really work? Does this really work? You know, so, you know, I took all the allergy extracts and I tried to mix them with regular toothpaste that was off the shelf. And I found that it didn't really work very well. It created a bit of a soupy mess, actually, when I mixed it together. First, I tried to make my own toothpaste, and I learned very quickly that I did not know how to make toothpaste. So that's when I tried the off-the-shelf stuff where I made kind of soup. And I found that the off-the-shelf toothpaste actually degraded the allergy proteins. So that wasn't going to be good at all. So, you know, we had to work and do a lot of formulation and development and trial and error. Brushing my teeth an endless number of times, trying to find something that would be able to stabilize the proteins and also to be able to release them and deliver them to the immune system just by brushing your teeth. And so that was a true journey. And a lot of that is just trial and error and patience. You know, you want something to work right away. We all want that. But, you know, it's really knowing that, okay, I found a way that this doesn't work. Let me try something else and see if I can find a way to make it work.
Right. And I'm actually very intrigued about, you know, the biological engineer factor of making that toothpaste and kind of creating it. So are there different types of, so are you going to create different types of toothpaste that align with the allergen that you have? So right now you're doing the peanut, right?
Yeah. So so far for respiratory allergies, for airborne allergies like pollen and cats and dust, that's already, that way of delivering immunotherapy is already on the market. It's being used probably by a couple of thousand people across the country, which is really gratifying for me since I came up with this idea one Saturday morning in my bathroom. But now it's currently being developed for peanut allergy, and that's going through a full FDA clinical pathway, which is a long road because mm-hmm. we have to prove that it's safe and we have to prove that it's effective in children, adults, and we have to do very, very carefully planned out studies for that. So yes, the first one we're looking at has peanut in it. And there may be ones that come after that have the other food allergens, maybe some of them combined together, possibly, we're not sure. But the first one is for peanut allergy, and it's really designed to help protect people against accidental exposures, because that happens all the time.
Yeah, that's great. So it's basically immunology, right? So the idea of, you know, brushing your teeth, because that's what you do every day. You brush your teeth twice a day and becoming immune to it and having your body respond to it in a way that is not harmful. So yes. I'm assuming you have you have to go through many trials and everything. So how do you know that people don't respond differently? You know what I mean?
The key factor for this is the activity of the immune system inside the lining of the mouth. It's an area of the body where the immune system is very active. And there's a very specific reason for that, mm-hmm. is because it's designed to help us learn what is safe for our body. generally things that go through our skin and everything, those are usually dangerous things like bacteria, viruses. But things that we put in our mouth early on in our life, typically were safe for our body. They were food. So the immune system in the mouth is really designed to teach our body what is safe to put in our body. And that's the ability that we're trying to utilize when we're doing this therapy. So we're showing the body's immune system these proteins at a high enough dose on a regular basis. And what it does is it educates or re-educates the immune system to say, ah, this is not dangerous for us anymore. This is safe. We can tolerate it. And it actually secretes certain chemicals called cytokines. And I don't want to get too nerdy on you with immunology, but it secretes certain cells that actually put the brakes on the immune system. So when you eat a peanut, it doesn't react like it's an enemy. It learns how to say, okay, it's a peanut, no big deal. We see that all the time.
Wow, that is fascinating. Yeah, I will be your first customer. I promise you that. So let's take a little fun break. I do this segment. It's called Fast Five Questions. And I basically ask you five questions and you're going to answer that as fast as you can. And I time every single guest. And I think the shortest amount of time was about 8 seconds. So let's see.
Five questions in 8 seconds?
Oh.
or do I?
Not 8 seconds, 18 seconds.
18 seconds. Oh, that's still pretty fast. Okay. All right.
Yes. Right,
I'm ready.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you five questions. Are you ready? We're going to start.
I'm ready.
Go to fast food restaurant or takeout place that's allergy free.
McDonald's.
Any great food allergy resources you're excited to share?
Food allergy research and education. Fair.
Okay. One word to describe allergies to someone who doesn't have any allergies.
Annoying.
One essential thing before leaving the house.
Wallet.
And then three steps to during an allergic reaction.
EpiPen, 911, repeat EpiPen.
Yes, you survived. Good job.
How did I do it? How did I do
that? That was about like 17 seconds.
Oh, okay. The new world record.
Yes, yes.
But that brings up a great point. Yeah, you know, learning how to use the EpiPen and delivering the EpiPen as soon as possible is the most important thing. You know, you don't want to debate about debate with your friends about whether or not you should use an EpiPen. If you're thinking about it, go for it.
Yeah, I know. I have this one friend who actually my uncle. We were at on the boardwalk in one summer, and he has a shellfish allergy. And we were all kind of paying the bill and everything, and we left. And he said he had to go to the bathroom really quickly, so we all left to go get ice cream on the boardwalk. And apparently, we a few you know like half an hour later, we're like, okay, where is he? I don't know, why is he still in the bathroom? Like, what's going on? Maybe he ate something. I don't know. He's still in the bathroom. And we see my dad sees his phone, and apparently there's like 4 missed calls from him. And so we all, and then a text saying my throat is closing up or I'm having allergic reaction. So we all go running across the boardwalk. He's sitting on the bench and he's panting, sweating. And he basically didn't have the EpiPen on him. His EpiPen was all the way in the car. He always just has in the car, but you're not also supposed to use it in the car because of the heat, and it can get, you know, expired or something, and he doesn't really know where he placed it. So thankfully my dad had an EpiPen and had to inject the EpiPen on him. And it was a really scary moment because his throat was closing up. I could see his face red, and he didn't really have that on him at all times. And it was very hectic. And it was also the debate of, okay, should I take Benadryl before that? I don't need the EpiPen. Because sometimes people are saying, oh, it's fine. Like, too macho to have the EpiPen sometimes. Like, oh, it's okay, I'll have Benadryl. But that's not the case. I think EpiPen should be just administered right away.
Yeah, there's nothing macho about holding off on using your EpiPen or carrying it. You know, does he carry it now?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so eventually he does care.
And the other thing, you know, when you do use an EpiPen, if you think you have to use it, you know, Learn how to use it correctly. And of course, you know, make sure you carry it with you, particularly if you're going out to eat at restaurants, high risk areas, places like ice cream, places where, you know, exposure to nuts and cross contamination can occur. You know, you have to make sure to get onto a hospital area after you give yourself the EpiPen. You don't take an EpiPen and then go back to the party or go back to dinner. That doesn't happen. You got to get to the doctor. You got to get to the emergency room because, you know, the reaction can come back again. The mm-hmm. effects of epinephrine only last 15 minutes really in your body.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So that's why it's important. Even if you can carry two of them, that's even better. But really, it just buys you time to get to the hospital. So that's the thing. But when you call 911, make sure to use your EpiPen first. You don't want to hold on with the 911 operator. Meanwhile, your reaction is getting worse and worse. Things can go south very quickly.
Yes, I agree. My sister, she was severely allergic to eggs. Her lips got blue, and we called the emergency room. We called the, you know, ER. We went to the ER right away. And it was a scary experience because it was the first time we've ever seen allergic reactions. So, no new parent, being a new parent or being a new person who's dealing with allergies can be especially scary because you don't even know you're allergic to allergies. And so you don't even have an EpiPen, first of all. And then second of all, you have no idea what the protocol is. So what is some advice to perhaps new parents who are listening right now or new people who just realized and found out that they have allergies? What is some advice that you can give them so they can feel a little bit more hopeful about allergies?
Well, I mean, probably the best information to get out is the information we know about early exposure to foods. Mm-hmm. It's been really proven very clearly that exposure to complementary foods like peanuts and fish and eggs and all these things really need to start early on within the first 4 to 6 months of age. Introducing them one at a time is always a good idea, you know, in kind of small amounts and see how a child does. And if there's any indication that there's any problems, they get sick after they eat it or have a rash after they eat it, you know, slow down on that one. And then a doctor can check things out. But what's really important is to expose kids to these foods at an early age. Unfortunately, when it's been withheld, as was the recommendations for many years, that unfortunately has, been one of the factors that has led to a rise in food allergy. So now early exposure is really what new parents need to know about. The science is totally clear on that. But if there's any indication that their child is having any issues with any foods, bring them to a pediatrician or an allergy specialist as soon as possible for testing and evaluation.
Yes, wonderful advice. I know a person who was actually on my podcast, and she was in her mid-20s, and she had had a reaction to bananas and strawberries and fruits, and she has been fine eating them all throughout her life, and then randomly she had rashes all over her body and everything. So it's just really interesting. I'm really curious about, you know, the scientific reason behind that, because I actually don't know. I do have any idea.
Yeah, and that's something that we're learning more about. And previously, the thinking was, well, you're going to develop all your food allergies when you're young. Sometimes you outgrow it. Most of the time you outgrow it. However, some things like shellfish and nuts can go on to adulthood. But now we're understanding that adults can develop and very commonly develop food allergies as an adult. Usually that comes from something that has affected their gastrointestinal tract. So some people, they get, illnesses, for example, viruses or even parasites if they go traveling to areas and they develop some sort of an illness. Or some people with autoimmune conditions, that can also affect their gastrointestinal tract. And that can allow foods to get further entry into their body. Normally, your intestines kind of keep the food a little bit separate from the inside part of your body. But if that barrier gets broken down in any way, those foods can get further in quickly, and that can start forming an inflammatory reaction. So, yeah. And that's probably why adults develop food allergies, because of, illnesses and other diseases that occur.
So moving on to, the last questions, I don't want to take up too much of your time. But I'm really curious, since you are a co-founder and you are an entrepreneur and an innovator and a creator, what is, you know, some leadership lessons? I'm really curious about some leadership lessons that you've learned throughout the decade of the time you've been, you know, creating many, you know, just OMIT and everything. So what is a leadership lesson in taking charge and making difficult decisions with people who demand so much? What is some advice that you could give to the audience?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of lessons that I learned, you know, being in the entrepreneur space and in the business space. I mean, I didn't learn a lot of these things in medical school. We did not cover entrepreneurship. We didn't cover very much about business. I can barely balance my checkbook. So I've had to really learn a lot of lessons. I think, you know, one of the biggest lessons personally has been taking time for yourself and understanding that you're not without limitations. You know, we all tend to think of ourselves, you know, particularly in the medical field, as sort of Superman, and we can do everything, but everybody needs to recharge and to understand that not everything you're going to do is going to be successful. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to fail, and that doesn't mean that anything is wrong. It's actually important to go through things and to make mistakes and to fail. Mm-hmm. You're never going to get it right after the first time. So that's a big lesson that I learned. And in terms of leadership, I've had to lead teams now in this area. And it's understanding that, you know, not everybody is good at everything. You know, it's the biggest part about leadership is understanding the strengths of your individual team members and having them utilize their strength as much as possible. That's really the mark of a true leader, is somebody who knows how to utilize the strength of their and the skills of each person to get the best effect, and so that they enjoy themselves as well.
Yes, I completely agree. I think kind of honing in on each person's skill and kind of highlighting it and making sure they don't waste any of their potential and kind of going to their maximum potential and, you know, just expecting the best from other people too. I feel like if you expect the best from other people, they feel like, okay, yeah, I can do it too. Like, I can do it. I expect the best for myself as well. And I've seen my mom, she owns a medical practice herself. She's an optometrist, and I've seen her work with her team and everything, and kind of they all expect the best from each other, and they all each have one individual skill that they give value, and they give value to their patients and everything. I see that, and I see the patients light up whenever each, you know, all the staff help them and their certain specific niched skill. So I think it's really important to do that, and I think that's great advice. Is there anything else you would like to say before we end the podcast?
Well, yes, the thing I would like to say is that I am so excited for what you're doing in the field. And I think you owe a lot. I owe a lot of credit, and we all owe a lot of credit to you and the work that you've been doing in the food allergy advocacy area. I think you provide such a wonderful service, and I'm so happy that you're in the world doing what you're doing. And I want to thank you for doing what you're doing. And please keep doing this for a long time.
Thank you so much. See, that is motivating me to do this for a long time, bringing in the best.
Great. Thank
you so much. Wonderful advice.
Thank you all for listening to this new episode of Less Panic, More Peace. And be sure to check out all of the links and the tags I have for Dr. Weissacker, and make sure to keep updated with all the amazing work he's doing. Thank you, and be sure to tune in next time.